This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director. I am very glad to have your company on this lovely fall Sunday afternoon. We'll have Jesse Nadler's two-part report on Mary Baldwin's graduation from college to university and all the ways that 175-year-old traditionally women's Stanton institution is carving a niche for itself in the 21st century. Also, Jordy Yeager's report from the contentious Planning Commission meeting in Buckingham County last week over one component of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and our island universe is coming up too. But first, you've still got a chance to see William Shakespeare's first folio. It'll be on display at the University of Virginia through Wednesday. WMRA's Sefe Imakpai tells us more about why the book is at Thomas Jefferson's University and what makes it such a big deal.
For the month of October, the University of Virginia is hosting one of the surviving copies of William Shakespeare's first folio.
Well, first of all, what is a folio? The folio term simply means that the pieces of paper used to make the book have only been folded once.
Molly Schwartzberg is curator at UVA's Special Collections Library. As she explains, Shakespeare's first folio is the first large format collection of Shakespeare's plays and represents some of the earliest surviving documentation of many of his most famous plays.
The first folio includes all of the plays that we know, Hamlet, All's Well That Ends Well, Much Ado About Nothing, Henry V, just to pick some of my own favorites, Othello, King Lear. Basically, Shakespeare's canon of plays is in this volume.
The book has made its way to UVA grounds as part of a nationwide project in honor of the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. Out of an estimated 750 originally printed copies, a little more than 200 have survived, and one has been placed in each of the 50 states and two territories. Schwartzberg says UVA was an ideal venue to receive the honor.
Our campus is itself a cultural heritage monument. So having this artifact that really documents the birth of so much of what we think of as the English language in Shakespeare's plays, right here next to Jefferson's grounds is just wonderful.
And she says the public response has been overwhelmingly enthusiastic.
Obviously, the first folio has been a huge draw. A lot of people are coming because they feel it's important to come stand in the presence of the volume. In some ways, it feels as though it's a memorial tribute to the idea of Shakespeare, the figure of Shakespeare in the 400th year since his death.
Shakespeare fan Caitlin Horton drove almost an hour from Madison County on opening weekend just to get a glimpse of the book she thinks of as literary gold.
I'm a huge fan. I've also performed some of his works, like one of my favorite is Twelfth Night, and then I also like The Merchant of Venice.
Horton was also a fan of UVA's own Shakespeare exhibit, meant to serve as a complement to the first folio display. Called Shakespeare by the Book, the exhibit explores Shakespeare in print form, Schwartzberg explains.
This exhibition looks at how Shakespeare has been transformed in the physical space of the book from, I guess our earliest item is 1619, all the way up to 2015.
It's very well informed and very put together, which is awesome. And I love that it's not just about the first folio, but about editorial as a basis, which I think is really cool.
The first folio will be on display through October 26th. The rest of UVA's exhibit will be open until the very end of December. For WMRA News, I'm Sefe Imakpai.
A new survey of Virginia voters was released last week by the Virginia Chamber of Commerce and touted by Dominion Power, showing majority support statewide for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. The wording on that question emphasized the pipeline's provision of, quote, energy and electricity needs to families and businesses in Virginia, and did not mention the possible environmental and property costs of its construction. At last month's Planning Commission meeting in Buckingham County, so many people signed up to speak about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that a second meeting was created just to continue the public comments. WMRA's Jordy Yeager was there last Monday evening where pipeline opponents greatly outnumbered supporters.
On an unseasonably warm October evening, about 100 people gathered Monday at the Buckingham County Administration Complex. Most were there to protest the proposed compressor station for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, wearing pins and shirts emblazoned with No Pipeline and No Compressor. Several dozen people joined in song beforehand. But inside, it was all business, as 6 members of the sheriff's department stood watch over the crowd, and 22 area residents got up, one by one, to speak their minds.
Look, I'm a realist, okay?
Paul Barlow and his wife own 20 acres less than 5 miles away from the proposed compressor station being sought by Dominion Power and 3 other large companies.
I know Dominion has a lot of money, a lot of power. $45 billion buys a lot. They have an army of lawyers that will litigate and litigate and litigate until they get their way. We request that you table this motion until adequate research is done and alternative methods are investigated to reduce or eliminate pollution and compressor station noise. Once they get that permit in their hand, they're going to do whatever they want to do. Thank you.
The companies are asking Buckingham County for a special use permit to install a station that would compress the natural gas as it flows through the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline from the fracking fields of West Virginia to utility customers in North Carolina. The station would bring the county nearly $9 million in tax revenue over 8 years. And in an area where 22% of the population lives at or below the poverty level, that's not chump change. What's more is that Dominion says the health and safety risks are small. John Arsenal from Prince Edward County agreed.
My personal experience there is why I support this project here.
For 30 years, Arsenal worked in the oil and gas industry in Alaska. He now runs a freight shipping company out of Fredericksburg.
These facilities are safe, they're quiet, and a marvel of American engineering. An example of what can happen living in Alaska for 40 years. Alaska's had no state income tax, no state sales tax. It pays every living resident in the state an oil dividend of over $1,000 to $2,000 a year. Run well, you folks can do something similar here. And that's all I'm out of time. Thank you. Thank you.
Many area residents at the meeting said the health and safety risks of a compression station and the accompanying 42-inch wide natural gas pipeline were not worth the potential tax revenue. Among a long list of issues, they're worried about natural gas leaks and what are called blowdowns, when natural gas is intentionally vented from pipeline equipment. Chris Arbo lives nearby and has a daughter with respiratory-related health issues.
Is Dominion going to send somebody over to my house in the middle of the night to stay up with my daughter while she can't breathe and her nose is running so bad that she doesn't, it's all over her pillow? This thing makes me very upset. And whatever carrot that this company wants to dangle in front of the powers that be in our county, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it. That's all.
The nearby spiritual community of Yogaville had several residents speak on its behalf, and several others raised concerns about the local African-American community, Union Hill, which was recently labeled an endangered historic place by Preservation Virginia, a statewide nonprofit group. The proposed pipeline would run directly through the community. A pastor from a church in Union Hill was arrested earlier this month in Richmond after protesting in front of the governor's mansion. Governor Terry McAuliffe supports the pipeline's construction. After nearly 2 hours, members of the Planning Commission closed the meeting, saying that representatives from Dominion would be given a chance to respond to the questions and concerns raised by residents at a meeting next Monday, October 24th, at 6 p.m. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Mary Baldwin College officially changed its name to Mary Baldwin University at the end of August, an event that also kicked off a year-long celebration of the traditional women's college's 175th anniversary. With so much history behind them, combined with the 2015 closing, then reopening of fellow women's school Sweetbriar, the name change reflects a drive to stay competitive in an increasingly co-ed world. In a two-part report, WMRA's Jesse Nadler is in Stanton to find out why this women's college still matters.
Just inside the admin building at the Mary Baldwin campus in downtown Stanton, there is a stack of yearbooks called the Blue Stocking. The 1961 edition features a large black and white photo of the entire student body, all women, all white, lined up outside this very building wearing white gowns and white gloves. School administrators Krista Cabe and Liesl Crozier point out a glass display of Mary Baldwin memorabilia on the second floor.
Yeah, we had May Queen, made it very old-fashioned, you know, celebrating beauty.
The images may no longer be relevant, but they point to one of the lingering stereotypes about women's colleges, that they're vestiges of the past, right up there with cotillion clubs. And women now outnumber men on college campuses nationwide, so the notion of a ladies-only school can seem a little anachronistic. It's a perception that was reinforced by the 2015 closing, then reopening of another Virginia women's school, Sweetbriar. Last fall's enrollment at Mary Baldwin was down 5%. It edged up 1% above normal this September. It's a tricky time for women's colleges.
We can't stand still.
That's Mary Baldwin president, Pamela Fox. She's been aggressively pursuing a strategy to avoid the Sweetbriar effect. We spoke at an event celebrating the school's official name change from college to university at the end of the summer.
We've changed our name 4 times, and each time reflects what the institution is today and how it's evolved.
Think about it. College says secluded, rarefied. University says inclusiveness, diversity. In fact, expanding diversity, ethnic, racial, gender, has been a key driving initiative to stay competitive. Granted, Mary Baldwin has been pushing diversity since the 70s, but that effort has intensified with the declining enrollment of the past handful of years. Here's University Relations Vice President Krista Cabe again.
We decided very deliberately to create a student population that looks like America. It was also a really good business decision. We're not a rich institution. We don't have deep resources. We need to make sure that we maintain enrollment, and that means reaching new markets.
Right now, Mary Baldwin is 51% non-white. Time magazine ranked it as one of the most ethnically and racially diverse campuses in the country. So how does a women's college with a long white glove pedigree attract students from such diverse backgrounds? Lois Williams is vice president of enrollment.
It's simply looking at your data and seeing where students come from and going back to those same areas to continue to recruit from them.
We paid a lot of attention to how we portrayed ourselves in our print materials. Over time, as the critical mass of minority population grew on campus, our visit days have become one of our best selling points because students come here and they know that it's not just one picture selected out of a variety, but it really is the way we live every day.
Optics may draw new students to Mary Baldwin, but it's not what keeps them there. And one thing you hear talking to students is that developing leadership skills is a fundamental part of the Mary Baldwin experience. Megan Edwards is an African-American and fourth-year marketing and communications major.
I'm a member of President Society, student government. I've been a leader as well in the classroom as a TA. So all the leadership opportunities here at Mary Baldwin, I feel, are a lot more competitive and a lot harder to retain at a bigger university.
You get used to being a leader at MBU, in other words. You're expected to be in charge of something. And this can be particularly appealing to women of color.
Somebody comes from a historically marginalized population. They find a great sense of confidence in them and a sense of their own potential, which then can be realized.
A big incubator of this trait on campus is the Virginia Women's Institute for Leadership, the only all-female cadet corps in the country. It's 64% non-white. Fatia Muhammad, 21, is a Muslim American and triple major. She was asked to serve as an academic advisor to the entire Corps.
I didn't think I could lead while being suffocated with all these classes. But after I got into it, it's not that overwhelming.
On her watch, the GPA of the entire Corps went up.
Motivating women to be a leader, and especially in an all-women's environment, it's really important. There's a lot of women, specifically Muslim women, that don't have a voice, and I would love to stand up for them and be their voice.
Mary Baldwin is one of the most ethnically and racially diverse campuses in the country, but it's still mostly a women's institution. But that, too, is changing, as Jesse reports in the second part of this story.
For we have built our legacy of 175 years and have prevailed. We shall no longer be called Mary Baldwin College, but Mary Baldwin University.
That's Chaplain Catherine Lowe speaking at an August event celebrating the school's legal name change from Mary Baldwin College to Mary Baldwin University. The name change comes at a time when many small liberal arts colleges, and women's colleges in particular, face enormous financial pressures, if not endangerment. To stay competitive, Mary Baldwin has had to reposition itself by expanding into new markets. Not only has it quietly become one of the most ethnically and racially diverse campuses places in the country, 51% of the current student body identifies as non-white. But it's beefing up its course offerings and degree opportunities, particularly at the graduate level. Here's MBU President Pamela Fox at the name change ceremony in August.
Really had this philosophy since the 1970s, but now we've really escalated it, calling out the Mary Baldwin College for Women as the single-sex heart of the institution, but surrounding it with an innovative series of co-educational undergraduate and graduate programs.
The current strategic plan calls for simply sustaining enrollment at the undergraduate women's college, which is just over 650 students, while expanding enrollment in all the co-educational programs that orbit the classic women's college. This part of the school numbers just over 1,000. This is where the growth is. The business school will launch its first MBA program next fall, and the school will award its first doctoral degree in May. The $28 million Murphy Deming College of Health Sciences, also co-ed, rolls out more master's programs in healthcare this spring.
The interprofessional aspect that Murphy Deming, that Mary Baldwin offers is just something that I think a lot of healthcare professions and clinics need to start utilizing because it's huge in terms of patient care.
Charles Beacom, 25, is in the Doctorate of Occupational Therapy program at Murphy Deming. He's sort of the embodiment of the new face of the school. Number one, he's a guy. Okay, Mary Baldwin has been admitting men to its graduate and adult learning programs for decades, but they still only make up 10% of the student body. The hope is that with more graduate and online opportunities, more men will enroll.
I mean, I'm actually the only male in our current OT program. So it's definitely taking some getting used to.
Number two, he's getting a doctorate. Number three, it's in occupational therapy, which is a departure from Mary Baldwin's classic liberal arts roots. This is another area where Mary Baldwin is evolving under Fox. A traditional liberal arts degree, the thinking goes, is not enough to launch a successful career in today's world. You need networking. You need professional development. For someone like Charles, you need to interface with patients in an actual hospital. In this way, MBU is starting to look more like a professional school.
We do field work every semester. It's easy for us as students, I think, to get caught up in the whole academic portion of it. But I don't think we realize how much we know until we get out there and we can show what we do know. And it's actually really impressive how well they prepared us for this, for the real world.
Low enrollment majors such as French and religion have been cut or consolidated, while more career-oriented programs like criminal justice and social work have been expanded. Here's Kelsey Allen, a senior studying criminal justice.
Going to a women's college isn't as popular because I guess girls like boys and the party aspect. We don't really have that. A lot of it is it's women encouraging women.
And this points to a major challenge for the school, trying to honor its traditional women's-only legacy while aggressively delivering the needs of the 21st century student. Here's President Fox again.
I would say one of the biggest challenges is just to continue the balance of our tradition and our innovation, and to continue bringing all the newer parts of the institution into one family.
Here's MBU alum Kara Jenkins, class of 2011.
We still are very deep in our traditions. You know, we have our junior dads, which is our ring ceremony, Apple Day, senior Mayfest type thing. But, you know, you really try to look to the future and see how women can be leaders in their fields. President Fox is a wonderful president, and she's really tried to think of different programs that will keep Mary Baldwin thriving for the future.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. 57 years after the USA beat the Soviet Union to the moon, there is a new race to our nearest companion. The Google Lunar XPRIZE carries with it a $30 million grand prize to the first team to get there. In order to do so, they must build and launch a robotic spacecraft to the moon. Upon landing, the spacecraft must either take off again and travel at least 500 meters before touching down for a second time, or the spacecraft may deploy a rover to travel the 500 meters from the landing site. In either case, the spacecraft or rover must transmit high-definition video and images for us to see from planet Earth. There are now 16 international teams vying to claim the grand prize. Three teams, one from Israel, one from the United States, and an international group have secured a launch contract while the remaining teams must do so before the end of 2016 to remain eligible. In order to claim the grand prize, teams must make their launch attempt before December 31st, 2017. The new space race is on. What kinds of innovation, new technology, and cost-effective methodologies will be developed? Will there even be a team that will successfully accomplish the task and take home the big money? We'll have our answers very soon. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Ollie Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.